He was beautiful and pure, but he was as flawed as anyone else. He offered his heart to you, but his soul already belonged to the woods, Bryn. Always. My soul belongs to Katahdin. Well, it did, anyway, before I gave it to you. I remember the words now, hear them in my head, the way the first half of the sentence was said with reverence, while the second half was said lightly and sweetly as he chucked me under the chin. He loved me, I whimper. Yes, he did. We would have made it. She stares at me, her eyes sad, her silence speaking volumes. We would have figured it out, like he said, I insist. Okay, she says softly, but something unspoken has already passed between us, and it is a tacit and terrible understanding. We might have figured it out. But then again, we might not have. We eat mostly in silence, and it occurs to me at some point that Hope is saying things I'd only say to someone I was never going to see again. And that's when I realize it. Tonight is our swan song. We haven't been friends, really, only connected by our mutual love of someone now gone. When she leaves for Boston tomorrow, she will move on with her life, and I believe she expects me to move on with mine. After tonight, we probably won't see each other again. Is there anything you want to know? I ask. About Jem. She looks up, her eyes softening, her lips tilting up in a sad smile, and I know I am right about our farewell. But she shakes her head. There's nothing I didn't know about him. I'm a painful reminder of him, I say, without bitterness. It must have been hard to let me come here. Bryn, she says, wiping her mouth before continuing. I loved Jem, but beyond that, he was my twin. He was part of me, more than any other human being on the face of the earth. On the night he died, did you know that I passed out at the same moment his heart stopped beating? 1 minute I was standing in front of my microwave, popping popcorn for a movie. 2 hours later, I woke up on my kitchen floor because my phone was ringing. It was you, telling me that he was dead. She reaches for the bottle of Merlot and refills our glasses. You were good for him. I mean that. He was really happy with you. He had high hopes, and I will always be grateful that he experienced true romantic love before he died. She takes a swallow, looking at me over the rim of her glass. Believe it or not, everything I'm saying to you tonight, I'm saying for him. She pauses, letting her words sink in. Do you understand me? I'm saying the things he would want me to say to help you move on. I clench my teeth, staring at her, bracing myself. She continues, gently. He's gone, but you're still here. You have to let him go, or you'll never find out what or who comes next. What or who comes next? Here is something I feel guilty admitting since I lost Jem. I long for someone. In my loneliest moments, I long for someone so fiercely it aches. I want someone to hold me, to whisper in my ear, to braid their fingers through mine and breathe against my skin. I want to know love again. In fact, I actively yearn for it, though I can't actually imagine accepting it. Why? Not just because loving again would be terrifying, but because loving someone else would mean betraying Jem. Reading my thoughts, Hope shakes her head. Saying goodbye doesn't mean forgetting. Moving on doesn't mean you never loved him. I'm telling you to let go. I'm telling you that you're allowed to be happy. A sob trapped in my throat escapes, and my hands tremble in my lap, though the evening is warm. Hope takes my hands in hers, warming them as she repeats softly, Bryn, let him go. You're allowed to be happy again. A helix of sorrow and relief shoots through me like a high-speed bullet. Sorrow and relief both, but mostly relief. Mostly a beautiful, terrible, long-awaited surrender to relief. My shoulders slump. My head falls forward to Hope's waiting shoulder, and I weep.
Chapter 6. Cassidy, 14 years old. 5 years ago, after my father's conviction, when life in town had become unbearable, Mama and I moved in with my grandfather Cleary, who lived in a cabin in the woods, way off the grid, in northeast Piscataquis. In this unorganized territory of northern Maine, with no local government and about 340 people living in 1,800 square miles, my grandfather lived on acres and acres of unbridled, untamed wilderness. The closest road was a dirt logging road about 4 miles away from his cabin, accessible only by unkempt ATV trails in the woods. I was 9 years old when we moved here. I was 10 years old when my father was killed in a prison fight. I am 14 now. Before we moved here, Mama and I had visited my grandfather every summer. We were picked up by a puddle jumper at DeWitt Field near Bangor by an army buddy of my grandfather's and dropped off on the grassy meadow by his solitary homestead. I'd grown up understanding how his unusual home functioned. The original structure was built by my grandfather, Frank Cleary, and great-uncle Bert Cleary in 1973 when they returned from Vietnam. At first, it was only meant to be a hunting cabin, small and tidy at 800 square feet, with a rainwater collection tank, a diesel generator, and an outhouse. But as my grandfather, who had lost his arm in the war, became disillusioned with the world he'd returned to, he made adjustments on the property little by little, adding on a kitchen, a sitting room, and 2 more bunk-style bedrooms. His brother came to help him every summer, and they managed to add a wraparound deck, a root cellar, and a small glass-enclosed greenhouse. They cleared trees and planted a garden, then built a small barn to hold half a dozen chickens, 1 rooster, a cow, and a goat. That same year, they winterized the buildings so someone could stay year-round and tend the livestock. And when spring rolled around, my grandfather decided not to leave at all and made the homestead his permanent dwelling. In 1983, at a conference on solar panels in Nashaw, he purchased enough cells to cover the roof of his cabin. He also met my grandmother, an ex-hippie from Seattle, who'd been thinking about taking the plunge to sustainable living herself. After a quickie wedding in Boston, they returned to Maine, and together they fixed up the original cabin, a woman's touch raising its general quality to that of a comfortable, if very basic, suburban home. The solar energy absorbed by the panels was enough to power 1 appliance at a time, lights, and other small electric devices. And they were happy, until my grandmother discovered she was pregnant with my mother. At first, my grandfather argued that raising their child off the grid was the best gift they could give their offspring, but my grandmother, whose sensibilities had changed with impending motherhood, found off-the-grid living less palatable. Without any formal medical training between them, she was uncomfortable being so isolated. Plus, she insisted, for proper mental development, their child needed more social interaction. Grudgingly, my grandfather sold the cow and the chickens, closed up the cabin, and moved his family to the closest proper town, Crystal Lake, which still had a pretty good view of Katahdin. There he survived, not lived, waiting for the day his daughter graduated from high school, and he and his love could return to the woods. Sadly, my grandmother, who died from ovarian cancer before I was born, never returned. After her passing, however, my grandfather quit his job, sold his Crystal Lake home, and returned to the northeast Piscataquis cabin, vowing to never ever leave again. Mama homeschooled me from 4th grade onward, and Gramp taught me everything else I needed to know to take care of myself. By the age of 12, I was capable of managing most of the property, adjusting and cleaning the solar panels, checking the rainwater tank, minding the livestock, and tending the indoor and outdoor gardens. The furnishings my grandmother chose in the 1980s are probably outdated now, but I don't really care. This cabin, with its outbuildings, gardens, and meadow, is my home. It's far away from prying eyes full of hate and biting voices that call you names you inherited but never earned. It is my sanctuary, and I love it here. Cass, come and help your old gramp in the garden a spell. I need to talk to you, son.
Sure, Gramp, I say, flicking a glance at Mama, napping quietly on a window seat in a beam of summer sun. In the past few months, she's started napping more and more, leaving me to direct my own high school studies. Last week, Gramp radioed for a plane, and it took my mother to a doctor in Millinocket, where she remained for 4 nights having tests. She returned yesterday evening looking even sadder and more frail than before she'd left. Last night, I fell asleep listening to the soft murmur of her voice as she sat across from Gramp at the kitchen table, both of them talking in urgent, emotional whispers. Here is what I know. There is something wrong with my mother, and it's bad. And as I stand up to follow Gramp outside, my chest fills with dread. I don't want to know, I don't want to know, I don't want to know. Sometimes you just don't want to hear the words.
Cover your mama up, then come meet me in the greenhouse, eh? He says, gesturing to a blanket with his prosthetic hand.
Sure, I say again, watching him trudge out the kitchen door, leaving me alone. For most of my life, even when my father was alive, my grandfather was the most important father figure to me. I never felt very close to Paul Isaac Porter, never felt the sort of love for him that a child is supposed to feel for his father. It's possible that his extensive travel schedule had stunted the emotional growth between us, but I know that was only part of the reason. I never felt comfortable around my father the way I did around my grandfather. Maybe it was the memory of that suffering raccoon. Maybe it was a sixth sense about who my father really was. But my father had been a nebulous figure on the fringes of my life at best. My grandfather, bigger than life, with a booming voice and the best bear hugs, had lived inside my heart. As I unfold the blanket on the windowsill and pull it over Mama's chest, the book she'd been reading slips to the floor, but I manage to grab it just before it falls. Tucking it under my arm, I finish covering her before taking a look at it. The cover of the book is a grainy picture of Adolf Hitler and what appears to be black and white high school pictures of several young men. The Last of the Hitlers. I turn it over and read the blurb on the back. At the end of World War II, the man Adolf Hitler called my loathsome nephew changed his name and disappeared. The British-born William Patrick Hitler, by then settled in the USA, remained anonymous. Until now. William Patrick's story so fascinated British journalist David Gardner that he spent years attempting to find the last relative to bear the Hitler name. Gardner found that his four sons had established a pact that, in order for Adolf Hitler's genes to die with them, none of them would have children. I know who Adolf Hitler was. Mama and I dedicated quite a bit of my schooling to World War II. Turning the book back over, I look at the young men on the cover, next to the picture of their great-uncle Adolf. They were his nephews, right? Men who decided, apparently, never to marry, never to have children, so that the genes of a madman would die with them. Inside my chest, my heart starts racing, and I drop the book on the small end table beside Mama, staring at it as if it were a coiled snake. Hitler's nephews had tacitly agreed to kill their bloodline. My mind segues without preamble to me and my father, and to those 12 girls he raped and killed. And I wonder, gulp, I wonder if Mama's reading that book because she thinks that I should do the same, that I should also make a pact to...
Done in there, Cass?
Jumping at the sound of Gramp's voice, I turn away from Mama and hurry to join him at the back door.
Yes, sir.
His blue eyes, older and sadder than usual, look into mine.
Let's pick some tomatoes, eh?
I follow him to the greenhouse, pulling the door shut behind me and picking up a wicker basket from the floor.
Ain't no good at sugarcoating things, Cass, says Gramps, gently pulling a tomato from the vine and putting it in my basket.
No, sir.
Your mama asked me to talk to you.
I clench my teeth and hold my breath, blinking my suddenly burning eyes as he places another tomato in the basket.
Sir? I whisper, but his words come quickly. She's dying, son.
The room spins and I hear myself gasp sharply, the quick intake of cool air hurting my chest as the basket slips from my fingers.
Easy now.
Gramps is saying as he takes the basket from me with his prosthetic hand. His other hand lands on my shoulder.
Easy. Breathing, Cass. You knew something was up.
Yes, sir. I manage with a ragged breath as the hot tears crowding my eyes begin to fall. His craggy face blurs in front of me.
Ain't been well for years. Turns out cancer was eating away at her, just like her mama.
There's medicine. Chemotherapy, I say, swiping at my eyes so I can see him clearly.
Too late for all that.
Gramp, no, I sob, leaning forward to rest my forehead on his massive shoulder. He holds me close, occasionally patting my back as I weep.
Get all that out now, he says in a choked-up voice after I've cried for several minutes. I'll ask you to be strong for my Rosie, for my little Rosemary.
His voice breaks as he says Mama's name, and it rings another round of tears for me until I am hiccuping and spent. Gramp releases me, walks to the back of the greenhouse, and returns a second later with two pails, which he upends across from each other so we can sit and talk.
She's always been there for you, son.
Yes, sir, I say, staring down at my hands and forcing myself to stop crying. Mama doesn't need to see my tears. She needs me to be strong for her.
After what your daddy did, some folks, well, they thought you might be a bad seed, too.
I look up at him, swallowing past the lump in my throat.
Cassidy is his son, ma'am. Thought maybe she should find a home for you somewheres, change her name, and start a new life for herself.
What? I am appalled by the idea of this parallel existence from which I was spared.
When?
He waves my question away.
Point is, she didn't. She stuck around. She stuck by you.
His face softens, and he says more to himself than to me.
Her snow baby, born on Easter Day.
My mind slides back to the book my mother's reading, and it occurs to me that she always seems to be reading books about DNA and genetics, and about people who have done evil in the world.
Does she think I'm a bad seed?
He winces, looking away from me.
She worries about you.
Do you think I'm a bad seed, Gramp? I want him to say no quickly, but he doesn't, and a chill races through my body, pinging off my bones and making me cold. He searches my face for a long while before saying,
"You're Paul's son, Cassidy."
"But I'm me," I insist, "not him."
"I ain't know what's inside of you, Cass," he says, reaching out to cut my cheek with his weathered palm. "I've prayed to every god that ever was that whatever was inside Paul ain't inside of you too, son. And you're a good boy. Seems impossible that you could go down such a dark path one day. But the reality is, well, there ain't no way to know for sure."
I know. I want to scream, but the truth is that I don't. The foremost terror in the furthest reaches of my mind is always there. Always, always, always there. The possibility that I could somehow turn out like my father. To know that my mother and grandfather share this fear makes it real to me. Makes me feel sick. Makes me feel like I'm living with a ticking bomb inside me. Even after we'd left town, Mama mostly refused to talk about my father. The way her face would seize up whenever I mentioned him made me feel bad. And anyway, I gathered that she hadn't known him all that well.
"He said he was from Indiana," she told me once. "He said his parents were dead and he'd used the money from selling their house to buy his rig."
My parents met while my mother was waiting tables at a cafe in East Millinocket. He'd pull off I-95 every few weeks and sit in her section, staying for hours and tipping her way too much. Over time, he started bringing little gifts, like pieces of jewelry, items that we discovered years later were trophies from his victims. Mama was beautiful to me. But compared with a few of the much prettier teachers I'd had in school, I knew she was homely. But based on my thin memories and the one photo I'd kept, my father was handsome enough. I imagine the attention of a good-looking, flattering trucker was enough to sweep a naive country girl off her feet.
once I asked her why he'd never heard us. She stared at me a long time before replying that she didn't know. I guess he'd lived two lives. "Gramp," I say, looking up into his weary eyes, "what happens now?"
"Be strong for your mama," he says, patting my knee. "She don't have much time. A handful of weeks, no more."
Another sob escapes my throat and I gnaw on my cheeks until I taste blood.
"After she's gone, we'll continue on here together, Cass. You're safe here with me for as long as I'm alive, and I'll teach you everything I can to be certain that you'll be able to protect yourself after I'm gone."
I cannot bear the thought of losing Gramp, so I push it from my mind. When I do, the grainy image of Adolf Hitler from the front of Mama's book takes front and center in my head. "What should I do about the rest?" I ask, wondering about the possible demons that lie dormant inside me. They could spring to life at any time, making me into a monster like my father.
"I know it would ease her heart to know you'll be careful, son."
"Careful?"
"Live quiet," says Gramp, using his preferred terminology for our isolated, off-the-grid lifestyle.
His blue eyes hold mine like two life rings, and he nods sagely, comfortingly, patting my knee again.
"Live quiet, and no matter what happens inside of you, you won't never be able to hurt someone, Cassidy. It's what your mama would want."
"Live quiet. Live quiet. Live quiet." "I promise," I say.
"Good boy."
I nod at him, vowing that the blood in my veins will never ever infect another life. I will live quiet. And Paul Isaac Porter's terrifying genes will die with me.
Chapter 7. Bryn. Hope had instructed me to arrive at the parking lot by 6 o'clock and told me that before hiking Katahdin, I'd have to stop at the ranger station to, 1, declare my intention to hike, 2, share the route I plan to take, and 3, give my contact information in case I should go missing on the trail. An ominous thought. Hope left for the airport at 5:30 this morning, and 10 minutes later, my Uber car arrived at her house, ready to take me to the Roaring Brook campground. Roaring Brook served as the trailhead for the Chimney Pond Trail, which would take me 3.5 miles up to Chimney Pond. From there, I would take the Saddle Trail, another 2.25 miles to the summit of Katahdin. It would be 11.5 miles round trip, and a hard climb for skinny, out-of-shape me, but Hope had promised that it was the route Jem would have chosen for me. Staring out the window at early morning, misty Maine, I wonder if I will ever see Hope again. But something, no doubt the same feeling of farewell I experienced at dinner last night, tells me that I probably won't. Our friendship had always been an extension of our mutual love for Jem. With his loss, so breaks our connection. I also think about her words last night, about letting go and moving on. The same sentiment I so abhor from my mother and various well-meaning friends struck a different chord with me coming from Hope, almost as though Jem himself was giving me permission by proxy of his twin to live again. To say goodbye. Spying signs for the Roaring Brook parking lot, that feeling of farewell surges within me again, and I reach into the outside pocket of my trail pack to touch Jem's phone, safely inside the evidence bag. Today, I will bury that phone, still bearing his dried blood somewhere on Katahdin, somewhere that feels right. I'm hoping that the mountain, or Jem's spirit, will guide me to the right place. While I acknowledge that burying a cell phone in a state park is an ethically gray area, I hope the universe will forgive me for leaving the small, thin, electronic device buried deep in the mountain woods. Some part of Jem needs to join his soul on Katahdin, and when I return to Roaring Brook this evening, I will bid farewell not only to Katahdin, but to Jem, who I want to believe would be happy to know that his final thoughts had led me full circle. "Here we are," says the driver, pulling over on the side of the road at the parking lot gates. "I don't have a parking permit, so this is as far as I go." "Thanks," I say, stepping from the back seat. I zip up my windbreaker, heft my pack onto my back, and trudge into the surprisingly crowded parking lot. Inside the pack that Hope helped me organize last night, I have day hike essentials, a Katahdin guidebook, a 20-ounce water bottle, water purification tablets, a first aid kit, a change of clothes, two pairs of thick socks, gloves, an extra waterproof windbreaker, a Bic lighter, a Swiss Army knife, a small flashlight, rope, sunscreen, sunglasses, bug spray, wet wipes, two apples, a banana, and a six-pack of energy bars. When hiking with Jem, I always noted a certain feeling of esprit de corps at trailhead parking lots. People from all over the world, from all walks of life, from all experience levels, come together in one place with one goal in mind, to summit a chosen peak. I understand why these were Jem's people. Clusters of hikers gaze at maps together, spread out on the hoods of cars, glancing up at the bright blue sky and speculating aloud about whether the knife edge will be a possibility today. Others share food, water purification tablets, or advice. Still, others keep themselves separate from the group, their faces focused and intense as they plan to add another epic walk to their roster. Knowing that this is likely the last arduous hike I will undertake for a long time, another wave of farewell melancholy washes over me as I head to the long line at the ranger station. Hope was right last night. I won't miss this part of my potential life with Jem. I can admire the beauty of nature as much as the next person, but hiking and climbing? No. I like my creature comforts too much. I get in line behind two girls, younger than me, who are chatting excitedly about the Appalachian Trail, checking out the size of their packs. About four times bigger than mine, I realize that they are probably southbound through hikers. "Are you AT hikers?" I ask. One of the two women, tall and fair, with a long blonde French braid that drapes over her left shoulder, glances back at me.
"Sort of,"
she answers with a warm grin, her English lightly sprinkled with what sounds like a German accent.
"We're sort of doing it our own way."
Her friend, a petite brunette with short hair and a similar accent, chimes in.
"If we were AT purists, we'd take the Hunt Trail, but it's a class two today, so saddle's safer."
"Class two?" I ask. The girls exchange a look.
"High wind up top? Possibility of rain later?"
explains the blonde. "Ah. So not an ideal hiking day, despite the blue skies and bright sun." The brunette gestures to my pack.
"You should tighten the straps. Want a hand?"
"Oh," I mumble. "Sure, thanks."
"Hey, you're not hiking alone, are you?"
asks the blonde, her perfect eyebrows squishing up.
"Yeah." "You're welcome to walk with us,"
says the brunette, stepping away as she finishes my straps.
"We're doing the summit today, and tomorrow we'll take on the 100-mile wilderness."
"Wow," I say as I look back and forth between the two girls. "That's brave." The 100-mile wilderness is the most challenging and arguably the most dangerous part of the Appalachian Trail, mostly because once you start walking, there are no towns or supplies for 100 miles. No stores. No police, no hospitals, nothing but the trail, lean-tos, and the woods. The blonde laughs at my expression.
"We figure it'll take us about 10 days, and then another 20 to get back to Williams."
"Is that where you go to college?" The girls nod in unison.
We're studying abroad this year. This is our summer project.
The effects of long hikes on friendship? I joke. The brunette chuckles.
Two women on the AT. A first-hand experience.
I like it, I say.
So join us today, says the blonde. I'm Carlotta. This is Emmy.
I hold out my hand, shaking theirs as we move up a few places in line. Thanks. I appreciate the offer.
Room for one more?
Asks a male voice from behind me. I turn around to face a dark-haired man wearing a baseball cap and glasses, an olive-green t-shirt and camouflage pants. His expression is eager, and when he leans forward, I can smell stale tobacco smoke caught in his unkempt beard. Huh?
I overheard you lovely ladies making plans to walk together today. I'm solo, too,
he says, his dark eyes lighting on Carlotta's chest. They linger there for a moment, wider when he lifts them.
Maybe I could walk with you.
Emmy darts a quick glance at Carlotta, then turns back to the man, her expression caught between wanting to be nice and not wanting some random man following us around.
I think we're all set.
I have lots of candy to share,
he says, opening his bag and dragging out two Snickers bars. He smiles, and I note that his teeth are a medium yellow color.
They call me Wayne.
Candy's not a good energy source, Wayne, notes Emmy.
Slowly, he puts the candy bars back in his pack, his smile fading.
Thanks for the offer, but we're having a girls' day, says Carlotta, taking a step forward in line and putting her back to Wayne.
But I know this mountain,
he says, his tone taking on a wheedling edge.
I'm local, born over in Millinocket. I could help you.
We don't need help,
says Carlotta, exasperation creeping into her voice, making her words clipped and more German.
We're sort of doing our own thing.
Oh, yeah?
His expression changes from cajoling to cold in an instant.
But you invited her to go with you.
She's a woman traveling alone,
explains Carlotta, crossing her arms over her chest, her eyes narrowing.
And I'm a man traveling alone.
He cocks his head to the side, narrowing his eyes right back at her. He points a stubby finger back and forth between the girls.
You know what you are? Sexist.
Pardon me, says Emmy, but you don't know us.
No, pardon me,
he yells, thumping his palm against his chest.
Pardon me for thinking that you'd include another single traveler in your happy fucking group. Fucking bitches come to my mountain.
Hey, I caution. There's no need for... His eyes flick to me dismissively.
Shut up, Grandma. I'm talking to the kids.
I put my hands on my hips and step to the side, blocking the two teenage girls from him with my slight body. You're being a total jerk.
And you're a bitch.
We're done here, Wayne.
I just wanted company,
Wayne cries, raising his voice loud enough to attract some curious glances from other hikers in line.
Then you should have brought your dog,
mutters Emmy under her breath, prompting a giggle from Carlotta.
Did you just call me a dog?
Wayne bellows, his face reddening and eyes bulging behind his glasses as he lurches toward tiny Emmy.
I said you should have brought your dog. Can you leave us alone, please?
Asks Carlotta from behind me, her face unfriendly, her voice direct.
We're not bothering you.
That's for me to decide,
he yells, prompting more hikers to look over.
I'm just trying to make friends, and this cunt called me a jerk.
Whoa, everything okay here? Asks a tall, blonde, college-aged guy in front of us.
It will be, says Carlotta, hooking a thumb at Wayne. When this creeper leaves us alone.
The blonde guy steps between Carlotta and Emmy, towering over them.
Hey, man, I think the ladies want you to back off. Stay out of it, hisses Wayne. It's none of your goddamned business, Junior.
Blonde college guy steps between the girls, standing next to me, directly in front of Wayne. He spreads his legs and crosses his arms over his sizable chest.
I'm making it my business, pal. Shove off. I'm not your fucking pal.
Got that right, says blonde college guy with a sneer.
Motherfuckers like you are the problem with this country,
rants Wayne.
Like me. You think you own the whole goddamned world. Dude, I'm about to get the ranger over here and have your ass hauled out of the park.
He takes a menacing step toward Wayne, lowering his arms and cracking his knuckles one by one.
You're seriously annoying people.
Wayne's face reddens to the point of fury, and he bunches his fists by his side.
Fuck you, he snarls. You're just tourists in my dreams. Bear bait. Shit with legs. I hope Katahdin eats you up and spits you out in motherfucking pieces.
Then he turns and leaves the line, trudging back into the parking lot until I lose sight of him between a couple of SUVs.
Wow, says Carlotta, shaking her head in disbelief. What a freak!
Emmy chuckles on tiptoe, still looking for traces of weird Wayne.
Heiliger Strohsack, what was that?
Just some crazy local, says blonde college guy, turning to face the girls. And by the way, I'm Chris.
Carlotta, Emmy, and...
She looks at me and giggles.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I don't know your name.
Bryn, I say, shaking Chris's hand. I'm Bryn. He gestures to two guys in line ahead of the girls.
That's Chad and that's Mike. We go to Bennington.
The guys turn around, offering grins and waves.
My cousin went to Bennington last year, says Emmy with a big smile.
Small world, says Chris,
grinning down at her like she's the cutest thing he's ever seen.
Where are you girls from?
Düsseldorf, but we go to Williams this year, says Emmy. This is going to be fun, says Carlotta, looking back and forth between Chris and Emmy before winking at me.
And suddenly I feel like I'm about 100 years old instead of 30. Maybe I should tell them to go ahead with the boys without me and let them enjoy the rush of meeting people your age and as beautiful as you on a summer day. But then I remember the look in Wayne's eyes when he called us tourists in my dreams. I nod at Carlotta and smile back, grateful not to be alone.
Yeah, totally fun.
Chapter 8. Cassidy. Present day. Hey, Mama, I say, placing a cluster of mountain laurel on the large, smooth stone Gramp and I used to mark her grave. She's buried about half a mile from my cabin, not far from Harrington Pond, where she used to take me for summer picnics. Miss you. Beside her grave, there is a slightly larger stone marking the spot where I buried my grandfather, 10 years ago today. He died 3 years after my mom, leaving me alone when I was only 17. Hey, Gramp. Miss you, too. I take a deep breath and sigh, placing my hands on my hips and looking back and forth between their graves, longing for them with a breath-catching ache. Been keeping up the gardens, Gramp? I tell him, squatting down to brush some leaves off the stone marker. Your tomatoes are still coming in strong. Bess died a while ago, like I told you, but I bought a goat off a guy in Greenville last month with some of the savings. The savings is paper and coin money that Gramp collected from the VA until his death. Gramp had all the checks sent to a mailbox at the post office in Millinocket. He'd go over there every few months to get the checks and cash them at the local bank. Because he'd spent very little money over the years and had received $1,000 a month until his death, there is still plenty left for me. Though my home is so self-sufficient, I have little reason to spend it. I have Gramps's old Honda 4-tracks, which can get me out of the woods when there's a need, but I try to stay close to home. Truth be told, I don't like dealing with people very much and seek them out only when I have to. My experiences with townsfolk following my father's arrest, trial, and death were scarring. I'm not interested in drawing any attention to myself or making anyone uncomfortable with my unwanted presence. It's just better if I live quiet at home, like I promised Mama and Gramp.
She should be a mule, I say. She's so stubborn, but I like her company. Named her Annie. I talk to her about history, Mama, and I swear she likes the Beatles, 'cause she's quiet when I sing. I can milk her for about 6 more months before I'll let her dry. Then I'll have to buy a male and breed her if I want more milk. I sigh. The thought of going back to town in 6 months making me feel anxious. I guess I'll deal with that when the time comes. I still keep the chickens, 1 rooster and the 6 hens. They keep me in eggs. Since you've been gone, I haven't had the heart to, well, you know. Every Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter, Gramp used to slaughter one of the chickens for dinner. But I can't do that. Besides the fact that the chickens and Annie are my only company, and therefore elevated to a status closer to friend than animal, killing anything leaves me cold. Even more than that, it worries me. I don't want to believe that I am capable of killing anything. It seems like an awfully slippery slope, given my genetics. I remember studying the Salem witch trials with Mama and reading about how some women were condemned to death for having a mole on their chests that resembled a third nipple. It was called the Devil's Mark, and the common thinking of the day was that evil women had such a mark on their bodies to nurse the devil. I don't have a third nipple on my body, but I have convicted serial killer Paul Isaac Porter in my blood and bones. That's condemnation enough, not only for me, but surely for the rest of the world. Most of the time, I feel damned. Live quiet. Live quiet. Live quiet. Sometimes I pray to a god I barely know that, regardless of my parentage, whatever chaos and evil lived inside Paul Isaac Porter doesn't live inside me. That somehow the gene that made my father kill those girls was a mutation within him that wasn't passed down. Or even if I inherited the gene, it will never be turned on. Or better yet, that even if Paul Isaac Porter had a kill gene, that the corresponding gene from my mother overruled his. I want to believe that she was so good, it would be impossible for anything evil from my father to overpower what I received from her. In the years after my father's conviction, Mama amassed a library of books about hereditary evil and genetics, and over the past decade I have read all of them. Some several times, adding to the collection now and then when the Millinocket Library has their annual sale. A Swedish study of Finnish prisoners found that the majority of violent criminals studied carried the MAOA and CDH13 genes, a combination also known as the human warrior gene or kill gene. The study revealed that a monoamine oxidase A, MAOA, low-activity genotype, contributing to low dopamine turnover rate, as well as the CDH13 gene, coding for neuronal membrane adhesion protein, can result in extremely violent behavior. In 2009, an Italian prisoner's sentence was reduced on appeal because he showed proof of carrying this gene in his DNA. And in 2010, an American man named Bradley Waldrop, who also carried the combination of MAOA and CDH13 genes, was able to convince a jury that his crime of passion, shooting his wife's friend 8 times in front of the couple's children, was manslaughter, not murder. Why? Because his genes made him do it. For every story of a serial killer's child becoming a police officer or a teacher and living a normal life, there's another story that supports the idea that evil can be inherited. And each one chills me through. 2 of Albert Fish's siblings were hospitalized for mental illness, and at least 3 more relatives going back 2 generations had a history of mental illness. Aileen Warnow's biological father was a psychopathic child molester who hanged himself in prison in 1969. The grandson of one of the Hillside Stranglers ended up shooting his grandmother and killing himself in 2007. The unfortunate net result of my reading is the knowledge that, even if I somehow sidestep my father's insanity, the kill gene could still be a part of me, inactive within me, waiting to be passed on to the next generation. It's well within the realm of possibility. And it's the terrifying fact that makes it impossible to imagine what I crave more than anything else in the universe. Companionship. Love. Family. While having children is physically possible for me, it is ethically impossible.
which means that despite my urges and longings, loving a woman is impossible too. Because it would be wrong to deprive a woman of children, and it would also be wrong to risk infecting the world with the terrible legacy I might carry in my DNA. Not to mention, by virtue of my genetics, I could be a danger to a wife and children someday. As a concept, I accept this truth. It's a little harder in practice. My body, which is hard and strong from years of work, longs for a woman's touch. I dream nightly of what it would be like to be kissed or held. My fingers, which haven't touched another human being since Gramps' death, probably shouldn't remember the soft texture of skin anymore, the warmth of it, the way it felt pressed against my own. But they do. All 10 of them remember. And sometimes I wish I'd never known the miracle of touch, the beauty of skin against skin, of my hand clasped safely within Mama's, or Gramps' warm, raspy palm on the back of my neck. You can't miss something you've never known. You can't long for something you never had. Once I knew the glory of human touch. Now I miss it. Generally, I'm pretty good at keeping my loneliness at bay. But it's been 10 years today. So today, it hurts. Glancing at the graves one last time, I look up at the clear blue of the sky, at the high sun of mid-morning. Perhaps it would be a good day to be around other people, the only way I feel comfortable. From a distance. In the woods, staying off the actual paths, but walking up the same steep mountain as the rest of them. There is a detached camaraderie that I experience by hearing their voices and listening to the crunch of their hiking boots over the leaves and twigs littering the many trails. I don't want to be around people directly, per se. I don't want to talk with them or share my name or expose myself to questions, but slipping easily through the woods on the mountain, seeing without being seen, a part of and apart from humanity, making my own way to the summit? Yeah. Today, I want that. Slowly turning my glance to Katahdin, I wonder how busy it will be today. Baxter Peak is an 8-mile walk from where I presently stand. 5 miles from here, I'll find the saddle trail, and I could shadow it to the top, listening to the hum of human conversation from the safety of the parallel woods and pretending I'm a part of the human race. For a few precious hours. I'll stay out of sight, Gramp. I promise, backing away from the stones. Won't draw any attention to myself. Won't talk to anyone. Nobody'll even know I'm there, Mama. I promise. 3 hours later, I'm sitting on a boulder in a heavily wooded area several yards from where the chimney pond and saddle trails merge, catching my breath. Earlier, I saw a lot of walkers through the trees, but more and more are turning around now, due to the cloud cover rolling in. The wind is whipping up, too, and the temperature's dropping. A group of 6 hikers, 3 women and 3 men, come into view, and I focus on them, quickly assessing their ages as best I can. Having lived most of my life isolated, I'm challenged by one of the 3 women. While the other 2 look younger than 20, she appears to be older, in her late 20s, possibly even 30. I can't tell for sure. Why she captures my attention, I'm not certain. But maybe because she's closer to my age than the others. I watch her carefully through the trees, tracking her movements as she sits down on a bench while the other 5 remain standing, laughing and talking as they take out their water bottles. My gaze shifts back to her. She wears sunglasses, but as she sits down, she pushes them on top of her head, taking a deep, weary breath and letting it go. And the world stops spinning. And all the oxygen made by every tree in that forest is sucked away, leaving me lightheaded. Because I have never seen such a beautiful woman in my life. Not in real life, when I was little. Not in books. Nowhere. Her eyes. Her eyes are the same green as ivy leaves after a rainfall, deep and alive, bright and unforgettable. The sort of green that heralds spring and promises rebirth. Glorious, vibrant, and wide, with sweeping dark lashes, those eyes steal my breath away. Her hair is a rich dark brown, held back in a ponytail, and her lips, which she licks after drinking, are red. Her face, with a smattering of freckles concentrated on the bridge of her nose, is shaded with a quiet melancholy that reminds me of my mother. Everything about her calls out to me, captivates me, making me long to speak to her and hear her voice, to watch those eyes up close as they look back into mine, to know something about her, to know everything about her. As she leans her head back against the bench, I wish I was the sun so I could shine down on her, so I could examine every peak and valley of her face until I have it memorized and can recall it at any lonesome moment. The sad, beautiful, green-eyed girl from the forest.
So what do you guys think?
My attention shifts away from the woman on the bench to one of her friends, a tall blonde woman with her hands on her hips. "Weather's definitely changing," says one of the men.
"It's colder and windier,"
adds a small brunette woman standing beside a tall, good-looking blonde man. "I think we should skip the peak," says one of the guys, and I can hear the disappointment in his voice. "Saddle gets gnarly in the rain. Can't hardly scramble up the boulders." "Yeah," his friend agrees. "Instead, we could take Dudley to Helen Taylor. Change up the scenery on the way down." "Let's do it," says the third man, the tall blonde guy, who grins at the brunette staring up at him. His voice becomes playful as he gazes back at her. "We have a site at the campground. You're welcome to stay with us for the night. We can try it again tomorrow."
"You wouldn't mind?"
she asks, her smile wider. They're attracted to each other, I think, watching their body language. The girl puts her hands on the back of her waist, which pushes her small breasts forward. I see his eyes drop down to glance at them for an instant. His smile widens when he looks up at her, and she cocks her head to the side and bites her lower lip. "Yep. Attracted." "Nah," says the guy, winking at her. "We've got beer and cards. It'll be fun." The brunette turns to her friend, her face expectant.
"What do you think?" "Ja, fine with me."
She nudges the woman on the bench with a knee.
"How about you? What do you think, Bryn?"
"Bryn. Bryn," sighs my heart. Her name is Bryn. She lifts her head to look up at her friends, and my entire body braces for the sound of her voice. I still my breathing, straining my neck to hear her as clearly as possible.
"I can't stop," she says, hooking her thumb toward the peak. "I have to go on."
Her voice is deeper and richer than I would have guessed, more mature than either of the other women's, which tells me I'm right about her being older.
"Bryn," says the blonde woman, "we can come back. I promise we'll reach the summit tomorrow."
Mesmerized, I watch the play of emotions across her face, the moment of hesitation that is quickly chased away by something stronger. She stands up and adjusts her pack.
"I'm halfway there. It has to be today."
The blonde guy steps toward her, dropping a hand to her shoulder, and I am immediately up on my feet, every muscle tense, ready to pounce if he should threaten or hurt her, and wishing like hell that he'd take his damned hand off her person. "Bryn," he says, towering over her, his voice imperious, "you shouldn't climb alone. Come back down with us." She sighs, and somehow I know that her reason for being here today goes far beyond adding another summit to her list. She's small and thin, not muscular like a career hiker, like the others. Yet she practically hums with purpose, and whatever her reasons, they won't let her climb down until she reaches the top. Today.
"I'll be fine. When I get back down, I'll come find you guys, okay?"
"Suit yourself," says the man, stepping away from her and walking toward the start of the Dudley Trail. A low growl of thunder sounds, and a light sprinkle of rain starts falling. I look up at the sky, then back at Bryn, feeling tense again, split in my hope that she'll turn back with the group for safety, but wanting her to keep going, because it is clearly so important to her. I hold my breath, wondering what will happen next.
"Bryn," says the brunette gently, reaching for her hand, "it's raining, and the higher you go, the colder it will get. Come down with us."
"I wish I could,"
she says wistfully, pulling her hand away, swinging her pack off her back and setting it on the bench. She unzips it and pulls a raincoat from within.
But this is something I need to do.
You sure you'll be okay?
Asks the blonde woman, looking over her shoulder in the direction of the three guys hovering close by. I could see it like a play upon her face, fear overpowered by determination. She forces a smile, nods at her friends, and slips into a rain jacket. Her voice is higher and sounds falsely cheerful when she insists,
I'll be fine. I'll come find you in a few hours, okay? Be safe getting back down. Go on now.
The two girls share a quick look, then lean forward and hug Bryn before waving goodbye. They run to catch up with the boys, the sound of low, manly voices and high-pitched giggles fading as they disappear from view. And Bryn, she watches them go, standing quiet and alone for several long minutes as her smile falls with the rain. And when her friends and her smile are gone, my heart clutches, because she looks so small, so sad and so alone. And though I wish I could join her on the path, walk with her, talk with her, find out what's compelling her to walk through a storm, I know I can't. Live quiet, and no matter what happens inside of you, you won't never be able to hurt someone, Cassidy. She lifts her chin, and I watch with admiration and a little bit of awe as she takes a deep breath, glances up at the sky, and hoists her pack.
I'm coming, Jem,
she says to no one, turning her body in the direction of the saddle trail.
I'm coming.
Chapter 9. Bryn. With the wind at my back and the rain whipping my hair into my face, I continue alone, all but blinded, slowly trudging up the challenging saddle trail and wondering if I am being foolish. Should I have returned to Roaring Brook with Carlotta, Emmy, and the Bennington boys? Is it madness for a novice hiker to continue alone? During our companionable walk from Roaring Brook to Chimney Pond, I'd seen a lot of hikers. But Saddle has considerably less traffic, many walkers likely opting, as the rest of my group had, to return below and save the summit for another day. But I have the heaviest feeling in my heart that if I don't get to Baxter Peak today, I never will. So I push forward, despite Chris's warning, Emmy's sweet concern, and my own trepidation. My thoughts turn inevitably to Jem as the near howling wind pushes at me and icy raindrops pelt my face, and I try to take some small comfort in the notion that his feet walked this trail dozens of times. I try to feel close to him, but to my immense frustration, I can feel my connection to Jem fading, even here, in this place that he loved so well. The trail is rocky and winding, and it impedes my slow progress. As the sky darkens and the rain falls harder, I have to concentrate wholly on forcing my body forward. As two hikers approach me, descending from the summit, one of them shakes his head in warning.
Bad up there. You can't see a thing.
His friend nods in agreement, squinting his eyes against the rain.
Not worth the walk up.
I wave at them, weakly. Thanks.
I mean it,
says the first guy as he passes, both of us turning slightly so our bodies won't touch each other on the narrow trail.
Turn back,
says his friend, making eye contact with me for a nanosecond as he walks by. I clench my jaw as their footsteps fade, pausing for a moment to tighten my hood. My hands are freezing, but I don't want to take out my gloves yet. I'm not certain they're waterproof, which means they'll be sopping wet in 2 seconds if I put them on now, and my hands will be that much colder. Underneath the gloves, in its sealed Ziploc bag, is Jem's phone, still smeared with the fingerprint of blood. It's that smudge that makes me keep moving through the punishing conditions. Picturing it, tears flood my eyes, and I look up at the steep, rocky trail, wishing I was anywhere but in these godforsaken woods in the middle of nowhere. Sniffling pathetically, I reach up and swipe at my nose before trudging forward. I promised Jem that I'd bury a part of him at the top of Katahdin, and that's exactly what I aim to do. No matter what,
Coming up on the left.
I hear a voice call from behind me, and I glance back to see two men with walking sticks making their way briskly toward me. As they pass by, I feel a renewed sense of purpose. They aren't letting the rain get them down. Nor am I. Lifting my chin, I soldier on, trying to ignore the weather, though my